This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowain. During the past year, Dagoberto Gilb has become one of the hot new writers to watch. His first book, a collection of stories called The Magic of Blood, was published last year. It won the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award for First Fiction and was a finalist for the prestigious Penn Faulkner Award. Gilb also won a Whiting Writers Award. All this acclaim led to a contract with Grove Press and his first published novel. And you may have heard Gilb's occasional commentaries on Fresh Air. Though he's been writing for over a decade, for most of his adult life, Dagoberto Gilb supported himself by working as a construction worker and carpenter in El Paso, Texas, where he still lives. This current success is quite a contrast to Gilb's life when he first moved to El Paso in search of work. That period is the basis for his new novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña. Let's start with a reading.
Mickey said he checked into the Grand because he needed a place to stay cheap, and this downtown hotel seemed as good as any. But once he'd been there long enough that he almost didn't wince about the smell, he got afraid he might begin feeling so sorry he'd also have forgotten why and what he was doing there. So then he got scared he was going to find himself in another situation right when he didn't need it most. Anything might happen with the alkies or uglies who liked yelling and fighting then spitting up or passing out on the corridor rug. Was Mickey the only one who noticed how it had been left there unvacuumed, not to mention unwashed, for so many years that a gooey, infertile mix of desert sand and cigarette ashes and whiskey and beer and blood and God knew what else had formed a topsoil? And Mickey was being stalked constantly by those winking and much too expensive bitches of questionable sex, swishing and waddling in and out of the conjoining rooms to copulate with men so sad that he couldn't calm his mind imagining what those groans and cries corresponded to. Mickey puffed up images of the future when that money came. Even a portion would be good enough. It was going to come because it had to and it was supposed to. He knew it. He believed. He had to believe because how could he not? Mickey entertained a whole range of potential fantasies. Faraway travels in jungles, on mountains, near oceans, knockout women who knew how to love. The most realistic was a car. At this loop in time, even an old car in its back seat where he might sleep to save a few dollars. It didn't even need to be that particularly clean. Anything that ran would do, because this place, the hotel, was not an answer. Definitely not what he was looking for. Not what was necessary for this business of his. He had to have an address so he could be reached, and this hotel was not reliable. And he couldn't live on the streets, out in the open, where he might have to explain himself, what he was waiting for. And why should he have to? He was no bum or wino. He needed a place to hole up proper. He needed to concentrate and be careful.
That's Dagoberto Gilb reading from his new novel, The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña. Well, Mickey does move into the YMCA in El Paso, Texas. Have you ever lived in a Y?
Yeah.
In El Paso, yeah. Texas?
Yes, I did. I lived there for more months than I kind of try to remember.
Well, how did you end up at the Y?
Well, it was kind of a bad time in my life, and I didn't have a lot of money, and much like Mickey, this story parallels a real life situation that I had. I had found myself with very little money and no job, and I was living in hotels and very inexpensive hotels, much like Mickey. And someday I met a woman that suggested that the Y was a good place to live. So I decided to do that.
And was it?
Much like this, the story is about what it's like to live there. And at some point, you sort of start losing your ability to know what's real. And so the novel is much about, it's as much about living in a YMCA and living in that reality or non-reality, that delusional place that takes over one's mind when he or she lives in it.
And were most of the people at the Y, like you, down on their luck, in between jobs, waiting for something to happen?
Well, it's sort of, I joke that the YMCA, the long-term residents, it's sort of the middle class of the down and out.
Yeah.
And so you're not quite on the streets, and you're not in a hotel anymore. But everybody there is, there's something, you're not there for good reasons. You're there for bad reasons, for something's wrong. Either that or you're old. There's also a retirement, kind of a level of people that are there for retirement reasons, if you can call it that. It's not a very good place to be in retirement, but...
Well, you write Mickey was good at poverty.
Uh-huh.
Were you good at poverty?
Yeah, I've always been pretty good at poverty. Still am, mostly.
What does that mean, though, to be good at poverty?
Well, like a lot of athletic skills, you're disciplined and you know how to control yourself. And you can, you know, when you need to not eat, you don't eat. When you don't have any money, you have to make choices about what you're going to do with that money. And sometimes it's not food. Sometimes it's maybe I'm going to eat a candy bar today. So I'll spend 50 cents or, you know, I guess it's 79 nowadays. And that's what being skilled and adept at that is. You just make decisions. And in fact, a lot of guys that were there doing that. I mean, you just, sometimes you don't eat. You eat, maybe you try to figure out one day, one meal a day and what it'll be.
What kind of jobs did you get?
Me? Yeah. Oh, I did all kinds of jobs. I mean, I did a lot of jobs.
Like?
Two, three jobs. Tile, carpentry a lot. You know, there's a job in here. I had a couple of these jobs, you know. One time, this Mickey goes through this job that I had, actually, where a guy, I go out and pluck nails and put them in tin cans. It was the oddest job I've ever had, actually. I didn't have any sense of what I was doing this for. This guy had me taking nails out of old lumber and putting them in tin cans. And
how long did that job last?
I did that for 2 days. Mickey only does it for a day. Actually, in the story, he's the guy. I had another job with the guy that I have Mickey working with. I did another job with this guy who had a fetish for Mexican women. But you know, I did that for 2 days because that's how long it lasted, and then it sort of ended.
So you have no idea what you were doing and why.
I got $2 an hour. It was under the minimum wage, and, you know, I'd gone out, and I just wanted the money. I said, it seemed like it was going to lead to something because it didn't make sense. And then the guy, when I was done with all the wood with all the nails in it, that was the end of it. Didn't make sense, never has. That's El Paso. El Paso's lots of things like this that don't make sense to me.
When did you first start writing? Fiction?
Fiction. I wrote a bad novel, like in the late 70s. I wrote a bad novel, which took me a few years to realize was bad. I thought it was a great novel. Probably is a great novel.
Well, who said it was so bad?
Well, now I do. But at the time, I'd sent it around and a couple agents. I remember this one agent, she said, some of this is just great and some of this is just awful. And I thought that, well, we can just reduce the awful proportion and just publish it. And the next book I'll have less awful and more good, you know. But unfortunately, that's not how it worked. But, you know, I just sort of started, thought you'd wrote novels. And I just what I wanted to do. I mean, for money, in fact. I thought you even got paid for it.
Well, you've learned the hard way that comes later, if you're lucky.
Yeah, kind of a lot later. And there's a whole lot of years between the later. You kind of forget that there's a lot of years.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is Dagoberto Gilb, and he's a writer, a novelist. He has a first novel just been published called The Last Known Residence of Mickey Acuña. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Dagoberto Gilb. Now, you grew up in L.A., is that right?
Right.
And your mother is Mexican-born?
Yes.
And your father of German descent?
Right. He grew up in he grew up in Boyle Heights, which is East Los Angeles.
What kind of a neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up over, you know, near Watts. It's now, there's a little junior college, near Western and Imperial is where I grew up. It's sort of mixed. It was mixed. Maybe 25% Mexican-American and mostly white. And then just across the street was totally black, you know. It was the years when, you know, we were the main thing on everybody's mind was race. L.A. is probably, in my opinion, the most racist city I've ever known.
In what way? In what way do you mean that?
I mean it just like it sounds. I think it's a very racist city. People are very racially conscious, and there's a lot of anger and different kinds of things going on. I've always been extremely sensitive about it. I'm a virulent anti-racist. I just get really upset about it because I grew up with so much of it.
So what kind of a kid were you?
I was more or less raised myself. My mom, you know, divorced. I didn't even grow up with my dad. And so my mom was this very pretty woman who went out a lot and was, you know, she went out a lot. And so I was left alone a lot. And so I always took care of myself. So I always had a lot of freedom to do anything I wanted. And so I did anything I wanted.
Did you get in trouble?
There was no trouble to get into because nobody paid any attention. I could do anything I wanted. There was no place to go home. I used to, I remember when in high school at some point, I used to ditch a lot. And I got real good at my, forging my mom's, you know, name. And I got so good at it and so calm about it that one time I remember I had, I just forgotten, wrote in my own handwriting and turned it in. And, you know, I go to the vice principal's office. And I've been suspended enough times for varying things like fights or something, and my mother was there, and you know it's kind of rare to see my mother at the school, and I'm with this vice principal, and there's a stack of letters, you know, that excused me for my absences and things, and on the top was the one I had just written in my own handwriting. Of course, underneath were all the letters I'd forged in my mother's handwriting.
So what was her reaction?
She looked and she defended me. Oh, yes, he was home. This is the great thing about my mother. She was just this, she always backed me. And of course, the other thing is that I wasn't really sure she knew if she didn't write those other notes because she was having her own troubles. I mean, she had her own troubles. So a lot of things, I don't know if she didn't notice or didn't want to or didn't, wasn't talking about that. She just sort of, as we walked out, she got, you know, sort of, her little mad, but she had her own so many other troubles. This is pretty minor league to her.
So when you weren't in school, what did you do? How'd you occupy your time?
Oh, I ditch and go to the beach. I love to go to the beach. And sometimes I'd go to other places, you know. I'd just ditch and go places.
And were you by yourself?
No, I had friends. My friends were mostly other kids that were from divorced homes. Mm-hmm. Those are my partner. Anybody that had parents were weird to me, you know, because I could do anything I wanted. In fact, I used to be very intimidated by people that had a father, you know. I didn't know what that was like. I didn't understand, so, and I'd go visit people's homes. Of course, also, I was always the dirty kid. And
what do you mean by that?
I was unclean, you know. I remember when I was very young, there was this one boy's, you know, mom, you know, I'd come in, and this was at a young age. She used to come and scrub me. She'd think that I would come off or something. I was too dirty. Because I didn't, you know, I was always taking care of myself. But I also because in the neighborhood, you know, everybody knew that my mother was, you know, my mother was the Mexican woman. And that was like bad in the, I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s, and my mom was the one over there, you know, and the attractive woman that went out with men and was divorced, and she was Mexican.
So did you feel you had to live down her reputation?
Yeah, but also, you know, anybody that said anything, I'd kick their ass. Mm. And that was how it was. On the one hand, I could think and be upset with her as much as I wanted, but nobody could say it to me because I wouldn't let them.
After your parents divorced, did you have any relationship with your father?
Yeah, I never lived in my home, in a home. He never lived with me, but by the time, I always saw him, like, you know, birthday, Christmas Eve, but, you know, it's sort of a distant thing, you know, it's sort of interesting to see him, but, you know, I knew him that way. But by the time I was 13, the great thing that he did, in Spanish, he'd be called El Mero Chingón, the head dude, so to speak, at this plant where he worked. My mother grew up next door to this place, and he was the floor supervisor. He was this white guy that spoke Spanish. 75% of the people in this big industrial laundry spoke Spanish. The other 20% were blacks. And maybe 5% of the truck drivers were white guys. And my old man was the main guy. And anyway, by the time when I was 13, the one thing he did give me that I'm really grateful to is I could always get a job, and I worked 2, 3, 4 hours a day and made money. And that money mattered because, you know, it's how I sort of lived.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of you doing this construction work or carpentry work and how different that must be from sitting down and writing, especially writing fiction. How do you compare and contrast those two kinds of occupations?
Well, in the simplest way, in a lot of respects, it's similar because it's, you know, when people are seeing you guys work, they see the large of it. Really, when you're working, it's this one small thing after the one small thing to the next small thing. It's one nail after another. And it's very much like that with writing. It's one sentence after another. So you have to be as meticulous, and at least I feel I have to be as meticulous after each one. And I admire these people that say they write these huge drafts and they just go. And I can't do that. I have to write one paragraph at a time, and I can't go to the next one until I finish the last one. And so that's just how I go about it. And then to that extent, that's very much like what a carpenter has to do. You can't really kind of do this one sloppy and then move along. You can't do that.
But is there something even physical about writing for you?
Sometimes when I've been upset, it's very much like pounding nails. I've been the keyboard's not big enough, and it's made of plastic, and I feel like, oh God, I'm gonna break this sucker any minute now. I'm so mad. But they are different.
Yeah.
They're definitely different. But you know, I guess I feel like, you know, my mental life or something, whatever you call it, the artist, right? I feel a little awkward when I say artist.
You don't think you're an artist?
You know, I think what a joke that is. But anyway, the artist in me, God, is that funny. But anyway, you know, likes that other thing. I mean, I like stories. I've always liked stories. And so I can't resist them. And it's sort of like getting into a good dream. When you're into a good story, it's like a good dream. And you just sort of lose yourself into the dream. And it's sort of, you know, as addictions go, it's a good one. It's not like, you know, drinking too much or smoking too much weed or heroin or something. It's writing. It's kind of a good kind. And you get into it and you sort of, you know, lose yourself. It kind of messes up your life if it's not going well. Mm-hmm. Because there you are. You're doing this again when you really should be working. You should really have a job.
So it doesn't feel quite like a job for you?
I try to pretend it is, but the thing is there's no paychecks. And also I'm like this bad boss. Sometimes I'm this good, you know, it's like I joke, since my German and Mexican, it's like this German guy's going, "Verk, verk."
And what's the other guy doing?
The other guy's kind of going, "Oh man, lighten up, let's have some fun today." And so it's always this conflicted, these two guys, you know, on each shoulder. This, you know.
Well, one of the things that I read about you is that you're a new voice, a voice for the Chicano people. What do you feel about that when you're described that way?
I'm mixed, and if you get the entendre. I like it, and I'm proud of where I live and, you know, and where I come from. And I like it when it's meant. Well, I just came back from Yale University, and I spoke to a Chicano organization there, a group of Chicano students at Yale University. And I was extremely proud, mostly of them. I just felt so good to see them and what they were doing, and I was just like, my pride was just, you know, just it was great. That sort of thing, when they like what I have to say, that sort of thing makes me feel good. Now, in other people, I sometimes feel like it's a way of diminishing what I'm doing. And I've always been sort of a construction worker, and I have an attitude, and I don't like it when they do that. And I say, wait a minute, how come I'm just not an American writer? I mean, why do I have to be a Chicano writer for you?
Well, you've written, too, about being hired to work on a show called Juarez, I guess. It was a TV show.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you came up against, and I guess it's this kind of Hollywood idea of Chicano life, which is that the plots had to do with bullfighting, tequila, whorehouses, and mariachi music. And that was the stereotype, the cliche, at least that show was dealing with.
Yeah, it was a funny one to me. They start off in this, there are these rich Mexican family, and they're down there in Mexico, in old Mexico, and they have bulls in their backyard. We all do, you know. And they're bullfighting. In the evening, they go to a whorehouse, and they're doing their toros, you know. And, of course, it's in a, you know, I always visualize that the scene would be these beautiful Mexican women and these black brassieres. And anybody that's gone to a Mexican whorehouse knows that that isn't exactly what it looks like. But then the next scene, the funny thing is, so now there are these rich people in Mexico, and suddenly now they've moved to the Segundo Barrio in El Paso, which is the poorest part of town. Like, oh, we're just going to move to the poorest part of town now. Like, they didn't know better, or who knew what, you know. But, when I got it, I sort of said, well, I know about as much of these people. You might as well have me write a show about Armenian people. I know that probably as well as these people. I've never known these kinds of people before.
Well, thank you very much, Dagoberto Gilb, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Dagoberto Gilb is a Fresh Air commentator and author of The Last Known Residents of Mickey Acuña. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.